Welcome to Le Bush Le Bebes.
Hello!
Bush Baby!
Raksararisa!
Season finale. I actually can't
believe it. It's our season finale.
Low-key announcement on the pod.
Announcement. Hello? What is the announcement? Do you want to tell them? Tell the Bush
Through
Babies.
Through our banana phone.
What
she
is this?
She is an engaged woman.
Woo!
I actually can't believe it, y'all. Like, literally, since we filmed our last episode, I went to Italy with Joe, and we went on this three-week trip, and, like, obviously I had, like, some kind of inkling because Joe and I have been together now. We have an amazing relationship. I'm not super public about my relationship on my YouTube or Instagram or even really here, but I will say that, like, we have such a great, supportive, caring relationship, and I always kind of knew, like, this day was coming, but I genuinely did not expect it to come this soon, so I was shook for, like, a week after it happened.
And since you've been back from Italy, you've been so happy, especially with your relationship with him. And it's just so great to see you two finally take it to that next step. Show them the ring. Show them.
The ring.
Yes. Yes,
it's exactly,
girl. It's so nice.
I love it. I think there's this happiness that I can't describe that has come along with this experience of, like, being engaged to literally, like, my best friend and soulmate. It's just, it brings me so much joy to feel, like, stability, I guess you could say, in my relationship. I think it definitely makes me in an emotional way almost feel like, oh shit, I am enough. And I think that's, like, very powerful and something I'm really grateful for with this experience, like, even more so than the ring or, like, the material aspect. It's like, shit, like, this is actually very, very, it's just a moment that I will always cherish, I guess you could say. So yeah, it's super special.
I'm just so excited for the engagement party. We're gonna celebrate. We're gonna have so much fun.
Oh my God. And you're gonna be the best at planning, obviously.
Yeah, because I'm Corey with me.
Hot takes. You just say a hot take on life.
My hot take is that I hate rainfall showers.
I know, feel a dagger going through my heart right now. I literally
everyone what? Loves them, but they come right down, and when I wash my hair, like, I don't want to feel like I'm drowning.
Wait, what about a rainfall?
I literally can't breathe.
What about a rainfall and loose shower head combo, though?
Yeah, that's fine, whatever. As long as I can switch over to the angle.
Yeah, the angle.
I hate when it's only above, because then you genuinely just feel like you're standing in the rain and you can't, like, breathe normally, and, like, you just want to get your hair wet. Like, I want to keep my face dry.
You have to,
like,
be.
Like, it's so annoying.
You honestly have to be super flexible to go with the rain shower.
I know, because
you
also
have to, like, do the turnaround, like lean
when,
over.
Like, when you're trying to wash your private parts, like,
you
gotta
stick
to,
your,
like,
leg up.
Like, how do you get under? You
leg
have to, like,
up.
Scoop the water up.
Leg up.
Okay. Everyone knows now that you're doing some crazy-ass fucking gymnastics in the shower. It's a lot of work. This is why I hate rainfall showers. That's my hot take.
My hot take is that pears are an underrepresented fruit and that they need more representation. Because, honestly, pears are delicious. They are crisp, especially Asian pears, very crisp. All pears have a sweet, subtle taste that's not overpowering and should be used in more items like smoothies, yogurts, cereals. Honestly, pears for the win.
Cereals? How would pears
like
be
like dried pears in, like, cereal? Like muesli.
No, that makes
vibes.
Sense.
Honestly,
no,
vibes.
No, I was literally, when you said it, thinking, like, why the fuck is it underrepresented? Like, what
There's
more representation?
Not a lot. We see a lot of strawberry. We see a lot of banana. We see a lot of peach. We see a lot of cherry. Where are the pears? Also,
At
we see a lot of apples.
Restaurants, bitch.
Yeah, they're the 1%.
Poached pear.
1% type of fruit.
Yeah, we need it.
We need more. We need more. More pears.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Love that.
What do we want to say before the season's done? Any last words or forever hold your peace?
I guess my thing that I would like to say is this journey has been so unexpected, but like something that I never knew I needed almost. And I'm so grateful that we got to do it together. And, you know, it's been like a wild ride, but so amazing to see it come to life and to see, I don't know, just the connections that we've garnered and the thought-provoking conversations that we've had and the guests we've had on. And I think it's been such a cool project, such a learning experience, and really opened up my eyes even to more than I ever thought it would. So I love that. Thanks for being a part of it.
One of the things that I'm so happy about as we're closing out this first season is how thankful I am of our whole audience for giving a shit about this.
Yeah.
Because it really is like a passion project for both of us.
Definitely.
And Corey for being the fucking backbone of this entire project and of obviously
our entire crew.
You. Because I have been behind the scenes my entire life as far as like work I've produced. And it's so rewarding but also nerve-wracking to be finally like in front of the camera and doing stuff, and I literally could not have done it without you, because there have been so many times where you start filming and I'm like nervous, but it's just, I remind myself like, oh, it's just me and Rox like chilling.
Honestly, I'm so proud that you have put yourself out there. It takes a lot to like put yourself on the internet and do so with confidence and do so while remaining to your core values and morals and being who you are. So I'm really proud of you for like putting yourself out there and doing this damn thing.
Cheers to our first season.
Cheers.
All right, let's go with the final episode where we're talking about the history of nails and the history of heels and what happened with that. Like, I have so many questions and I can't wait to hear you talk about it, Rox, about like why nail decoration is such a feminine thing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously now that we're in like the trendier like e-boy world of society, there are a lot of men who are now rejecting that idea of it being feminine and doing
which we love.
But why was it a feminine thing in the first place? And I can't wait to hear more. So
totally,
let's get it rolling.
Yes. So I'm going to be doing history of nails. And I feel like when we were thinking about these topics and which ones we wanted to be researching, nails really spoke to me because I'm like weirdly sensitive about my nails. Like, you've literally seen me cry multiple times about my nails.
It's not weird. Like, don't be judgmental towards yourself.
Yeah, I can't be judgmental. Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. But it's a thing. Like, I'm very sensitive about my nails. And like, I think it comes from, I've had long ass nails. I have long ass nails right now, but I've had long ass nails for a long time.
They look
and
gorgeous.
I love them.
We got them done together.
Yes, we got them done together. Yeah. But I definitely remember a time where like I felt very judged when I like would walk into a room and people would look at my nails weird, or, you know, this was just a form of self-expression. And there's been many straight males that have commented on my nails and just like commented very demeaning sort of things that like make me feel judged. So this is for all of my gals and guys out there that love a good long manicure. Live your life, boo. Don't let anyone tell you or ask you, how do you wipe your ass and like shit like that? Because I feel like comments like that are way too common. So do you. But anyways, history of nails. Let's do it. So dating back about 5,000 years, that's a long ass time.
Yeah.
The focus on beautifying our nails began back in 32,000 BC. And back then, both men and women are suspected to have dyed their nails, creating color tips, utilizing natural resources like plant extracts, henna, coal, beeswax, Arabic gum, egg whites.
Wow.
Vibes. Egg whites. We love a good egg white moment.
Yeah.
And often they used ingredients like orchids, roses, or even local flowers, of course, dependent on the area of origin, to further achieve that toned, stained color of choice.
Wow, interesting.
Back in ancient Egypt, it said that black and red were the most popular shades, also adding in that metallic silver and gold powders, which I was like, chrome nails, vibes. Okay, vibes. Sick. Okay, we're bringing back the ancient Egyptians. Yeah. But for much of history, painted nails really did mark the social status you were in, meaning that upper class, you know, ranked within society had a different mm-hmm. nail color than the middle or lower ranking classes. So regardless of gender, at this time, it was all about the color and ranking. It wasn't about men versus women. Yeah.
Can't people just put whatever color they want to try to like be in other class?
Yeah.
Like, well, who controls?
Okay, so back then they used to get fines. They would be like scrutinized
if they put the wrong color.
Yeah, if they put the wrong color on.
Damn.
I know. So it's like very like law abiding. Like you had to wear the color for your class. And if you were caught wearing colors that were not part of your class, like if a commoner was caught wearing a royal color or whatever, then they were literally shamed, scrutinized, and often fined.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane. The color of our nails. The start is said to come from Babylonia in 32,000, like I said, BC. And back then, green denoted the common man. Warriors were the main people using nail colors. Oftentimes, like lighter colors were to denote like the more common class or the lower class. And then darker pigments of colors were like the royal class, the higher class, the monarchies. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of interesting to me. And I think it had something to do with just like the natural ingredients that were available at that time, and more pigmented ingredients were only reserved for higher class members. So fast forward a couple hundred years, in 3000 BC, China, the lower classes, again, reportedly were using subdued tones. So like the egg whites, the Arabic gum, the beeswax. Yeah. Whereas, again, members of that higher ranking ruling family, the royals, etc., would have been wearing reds. So China, reds were very predominantly seen on the royals. Jumping to like Egyptians, Cleopatra was speculated to dip her hands in henna to achieve her iconic blood red nail shade, which to this day denotes like this very femme fatale feel, yeah. which I feel like can literally date back to her influence on That's nails so and how nails are decorated and yeah. how nails were really portrayed. Because I think she was one of the first figures in history to use that like very iconic blood red, like almost like that yeah. deeper red shade on her nails. And she would do not only just her nail beds, but actually like the whole tips of her fingers.
Wow.
To add to that like aesthetic. And I mean, we love the aesthetic, Cleo.
We should do that.
I know. I like vibes. Cool. It really is interesting that for a lot of history, you know, the act and art of painting nails was nearly a genderless act. Like it wasn't reserved for one gender versus the other. It was kind of mainly men and women participating in the act of decorating their nails. And there's not a lot of historical documentation on exactly how the act of painting nails has shifted into like our modern society as more of a feminine expression. But history does say that by the 1800s, this shift had most definitely taken place. So sometime between that era, which is a huge era, mm-hmm. but again, not a lot of documentation was apparent mm-hmm. on the webs, but that shift had definitely taken place. So by the 1800s, you know, women were really the ones vying for manicures as a sign of cleanliness and again status. Like I think at that time it was very much so like the lower classes were viewed as dirtier. So I think that for women of that time, it started to become this thing of like, I'm well groomed, I'm clean, I'm ready to go, mm-hmm. I'm a higher class, like I have elegance to me. And I think at this time, like really the modern social construct of that male identifying masculinity was becoming more present. And, you know, the idea of like the real man, the burliness, mm-hmm. that like lack of grooming even was becoming very, very construed in our society by the 1800s. Wow. And now I would say we are definitely seeing that shift to all people in polishing. Again, going back to like this less constructed gender-based mindset when it comes to nails almost as we saw centuries ago. And like in my research, I was actually seeing a lot of articles in the media about like Harry Styles and other celebrities of today's day and age. They're even describing it, and their stylists are describing it as an ode to the genderless description of this act from centuries ago, because history does say that it is genderless. I mean, for a long time it was based on social ranking, which is definitely not something that I think we need to go back on. But I think we can pull from like the gender ties that come from like the origins of the art of painting our nails.
Yeah.
And even in like on TikTok, LA and New York, I feel like this trend of men in polish is popping off, but I'm hesitant to even call it a trend because like, I truly hope that it isn't. I truly hope that it's something that sticks around. That's something that is more ingrained into like the younger generations growing up, that like, fuck it. It's not about men or women. It's about you and your own opinion and your own choices with your self-expression. And if you want to fucking paint your nails, or if you want to add long ass 12 inch nail extensions, like do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I also want to add though, because we mentioned Harry Styles as being like the one who's doing his nails and like the forefront of how gender expression isn't the same as gender identity and sexuality, but he is running because of so many other people like pushing that boundary before him, including Kurt Cobain, David Bowie, Billy Porter, who have been pushing this boundary of what it means to express your own gender in order for Harry to have this platform on the cover of Vogue in a dress.
Definitely. I think it's been a long time coming, and there's been a lot of impactful figures that have added to this like staircase, if you will, to get to the place that we're at now. In my research, I found that even in some of the most gender rigid countries like Japan, for instance, we're really seeing men in polish statistically rising, with Nailbook reporting that 40% of men were actually complimented on their painted nails in a 2021 questionnaire. Nice. And in a direct quote, it says that the results of the survey also showed that men were not painting their nails to garner popularity with the opposite sex. Rather, they did it simply because they wanted to. I thought that that 40% is a huge amount of men being like, no, I'm going to do this for myself, not for anybody else, not for my dating preferences or my sexual preferences, just because I want to do it. So I thought that was like a cool thing. I think it's really important to get the viewpoints of, you know, people who have really been affected by gender stereotypes when it comes to nail expression, if you will. So a really great article that I would definitely encourage all of our BBs to read, which we will link down below, is titled Archer, the Harm of Gender Stereotypes, Nail Polish and the Fragility of Masculinity, written by Aram Hosey, a longtime political and LGBTI advocate in Australia and internationally while serving on the board of the Victorian AIDS Council. So Aram identifies as a queer trans man and speaks on the societal judgment he has experienced in wearing polish after transitioning to a male body, and how it compares to, you know, the disturbing judgment experienced as a teenager when embracing his first queer love story prior to transitioning. So he speaks on his experience before transitioning and after transitioning, and how wearing nail polish was taken in a different light when he was in a female body versus in a male body, which I just thought was a very firsthand perspective that is insightful, and it's powerful in the way that it's written. And you know I love my direct quotes, so this is a lengthy but very impactful direct quote from the article, which again I would highly recommend everybody to read. But basically the direct quote says, "Wrapped up in all of this is the thing I find most disturbing, the profound devaluing in our society of all that is considered feminine. When gay men get abused and bashed, it is often the more obviously gay. And by obvious, what we're really saying is feminine. The slurs hurled against them are gender-based, either outrightly so, like sissy, or more circuitously via reference to being sexually penetrated, just like women are. It seems seems that nearly all of the slurs in popular uses reference femaleness, whether it's doing anything like a girl or calling someone a bitch, a cow, a cunt. Meanwhile, the violence wrought against trans women is especially horrific. And lesbians in some countries are, for the crime of behaving not as women should, subjected to corrective rape. Breaking down gender inequality isn't a side issue. It isn't a women's issue. It's an everybody issue because the continued existence of these gendered stereotypes limits and hurts us all. And I think just by this beautifully written article, it really opens up the mindset to seeing the bigger picture when it comes to gender equality and, you know, whether it be how you paint your nails or the color you paint your nails or how you dress or how you act or how feminine your movements are or masculine your movements are, for that matter. Like, whatever it is, you should feel free to be who you are. That's my history on nails.
Wow. It's so crazy though that it did become such a gendered thing.
Yeah, because it didn't start off that way. Yeah. And it went thousands of years, literally thousands of years, without being this like very gendered thing. And I think even dating back to like 10 years ago, when you would see a male walking down the street with nail polish on, it garnered a lot of attention. Yeah. And people would talk about it or make a comment. And that's, I think, what, you know, in that article that I was just referencing, that's what we don't need, because it's a very judgmental way that society has reacted to, yeah, this, again, once genderless act that has, yeah, now within the last couple hundred years become gendered and become this feminine thing. But like, who gives a fuck?
Now it is time to talk about the history of heels. In 3500 BC, Egyptians were the first to have documented heels or be wearing elevated shoes. And Egyptian butchers actually wore high-heeled shoes in order to walk above the blood of slaughtered animals. Yeah.
What a dark past.
Yeah, so it actually had a very practical background. Like, it wasn't
practical, but dark.
Yeah. And then after that, the Persian cavalry wore a kind of heeled boot, uh-huh, called a galesh. And those heels made them fit in stirrups easier. So it was Persian arrow shooters who stood up on galloping horses and didn't need to like hold onto the horse in order to safely ride it with the heels that would hook into the stirrups. That is now kind of translated and seen in like the Western cowboy boot, which still has a little heel, mm-hmm, because it serves that same purpose of like hooking into the stirrups. Mm-hmm. And back then in Persia, it was a status indicator because it meant you owned a horse if you were wearing them, which was of elite status. Skip to the 11th century. The Pope notably began wearing red-heeled shoes, which was something to call out because it's the first time, mm-hmm, in Western society that people were starting to wear heels. And then in 1430, during the medieval period in Europe, both men and women wore platform shoes. Women wore heels to raise themselves out of the trash and excrement that filled the streets.
Oh my God.
So heels actually moment. During that time reached a height of up to 30 inches.
What?
Yeah. As a way to raise yourself above all the garbage.
Platform vibes.
In the streets, yeah. Deaf platform
we love
vibes.
A platform moment, honestly.
And then there was a Venetian law that limited the height to heels to 3 inches, but the regulation was ignored. So then skip to the 17th century. Modern high heels were brought to Europe by Persia and Abbas the Great, who was the leader in that early 17th century. And in the Elizabethan era, cavalier boots were introduced for riding. Mm. And these originally had like really low heels, but by the time of the English Civil War, stacked heels of up to 2 inches were common. So they did get taller. And this is something I have to call out based on all the research I've done with this, is that historians still considered, you know, boots with a tiny little heel as heels in this. So that's a distinction to be made, like, when I'm talking about some of this. Because, like, a 2-inch, like, boot isn't a heel, you know, in my mind.
We're talking stilettos, baby. Yeah, stilettos. Yeah.
So just as European men began wearing high heels, women's fashion also took on a more masculine look. And so trend-setting women who imitated this mannish vibe, which I related to so much because that's literally my entire aesthetic, is being called literally by historians a mannish woman, quote-unquote mannish woman.
You are the embodiment.
And they were accused of having their hair cut in manly styles and were lampooned for wearing military-inspired accessories, wearing broad-brimmed hats, and ornamented with plumes. I don't even know what the fuck that means, but, like, I would be doing that plume shit if I was back in the 17th century.
Let's get Rachel in the plumes, though.
They were also wearing boots with spurs that had heels on them, so that was them kind of imitating this manly style, quote-unquote. Heels footwear was another means by which women masculinized their attire in the early 17th century. So it's interesting that it kind of all started by women imitating men.
Yeah.
And then now it's a fully feminine thing. Yeah. If we fast forward to today. The English also wore heels of significant height. But as the century progressed, many of these heels became associated with the more rugged forms of masculinity, which were like the boots and such. In 1666, King Charles II started a new fashion for men, quote unquote, after the Persian mode, inaugurating the three-piece suit and ushering in the demise of the heel. So heels went out in status for a bit at the end of the 1600s to early 1700s. And they only kept the three-piece suit. And that's something that we'll probably cover in season two, where we talk about, like, the history of dresses or skirts and fashion and, like, where that all stems from. But I thought that was an interesting thing, that three-piece suit and heels came from the Persians. Then, in the 1700s later, men wore heels to imply their upper-class status. King Louis IX, for example, did that. And then they introduced the red heel, which was a very elitist form of a heel, and it came with specific rules. So this is a really funny quote that I found. A half inch was for commoners, 1 inch was the bourgeoisie, and 1.5 inches was for knights, 2 inches was for nobles, and 2.5 inches was for princes. So they had
very
literal,
specific.
Yeah. Specifications for the height of your heel, meaning your status in society. So this is the first time in this century where heels started becoming more gendered. So women began to wear heeled shoes in the mid to late 17th century, and societal trends moved to distinguish men's from women's heels. So this is when we started seeing men's heels being like The boots, the rugged for a purpose, practical, and women's started becoming for fashion. So in the 18th century, men wore thick heels while women wore thin ones. Men's heels began to concentrate on either practical riding boots or tall leather boots worn for status. And in the late 1780s, societal implications of wearing high and thin heels became gendered. So that was feminine if you were wearing like a really high, thin heel. By the end of the 1700s, high and thin heels represented femininity and the supposed superficiality of the extravagance of women. So it kind of meant like, oh, you don't have to work. You don't have to, you know, run around and use physical labor to accomplish tasks. Like, you can walk around on these little itty bitty nails and still live a life. So I thought that was very interesting. It started out that French heels in the late 1600s, around 1720s, it was the first time wearers had to put weight on the ball of their foot, and it wasn't just a platform. And they were also decorated with lace or fabric. And then wide heels became a bit more popular in the 1730s and 40s. And then they became skinnier up until the 60s. And then in the 90s, the trend saw more experimentation with colors. That is just a call out as far as the design of these heels.
The design.
You know?
The design. We love the design. We love a good visual here on Bush Babies.
Yeah. And I thought it was very funny that in 1770, there was an act introduced into the parliament which applied the same penalties to use high heels and other cosmetic devices that would have been applied in the case of witchcraft. So if you used your heels to get a man and were accused of witchcraft because of it, you were shunned and prosecuted
no,
by the government.
We don't love that.
1800s, heels went out of fashion in the early 1800s.
They were out.
Yeah.
Not they the said vibe, no. Love. They were like, nah, girl.
And then in the 1850s, they increased with the invention of mass production of the sewing machine. So heels were easier to make. So then they became really popular again. The two most popular heels at this time are the Pinnett heel and the Cromwell heel, which is so crazy to look at when you look at the photos. And if you're on our YouTube, you'll probably get to see them. So by the 1900s, when the two world wars happened during the 20th century, it led to a shortage of materials. So heels started being made with cork and wooden shoes instead of the other materials being used, like leather. Due to the post-war increase in international communication, like photography and film, Western fashion became really popular, and that included high heels. So the obsession with high heels spread globally as communication increased and Western civilization influenced the rest of the globe. So in the early post-war period, brown and white pumps with cutouts or ankle straps became very popular, and open toe. So that's when we're seeing, you know, us having to get our nails done just to wear fucking heels, which I am against.
And that's honestly the two topics collide. The nails are shown in the heels because open toed has
entered
the chat.
The nails, baby. At this time, high heel shoes became a symbol of professionalism for many women in the West. Leather and rubber thick-heeled boots became popular for men, and it was associated with the military and masculinity. So that's another time when, like, the divide became even larger between, like, feminine heels and masculine heels. And this is why I brought up earlier why it's so interesting that they still consider these boots as heels, because in my mind, like, a military boot with, like, this much of a heel is not, like, what our focus is.
Right.
But it's interesting that, yeah, they do still have heels if we're talking about it in, like, a literal sense. So in World War II, we saw the popularization of the pinup girl and pinup girl posters. Mm-hmm. And every single woman in those had heels.
Like a big-ass stiletto.
Yeah. And the booty was out. The tits were out. We were, like, trying to inspire everyone to fight for America.
We were like, let's use our bodies. Let's fight.
Yeah. This led to an increase in the strength of relationship between high heels and feminine sexuality. So in 1950, the tall and skinny stiletto heel was invented for the first time and became an emblem of female sexuality. So that is, I think, how we all imagine, like, your typical heel today.
Yeah.
Which was only invented, like, 72 years ago.
Which is honestly crazy, because I think as you grow up, you just kind of feel like a heel has always looked like that. Like, I feel like you, like we're saying, we don't even think about the booties or, like, these military sort of styles as heels. But in the literal term of the word, yes, they are used to describe that type of shoe. But in our modern society, this is definitely what we think of as, like, the start of the heel, I would say. Which, 72 years is not much.
No, it's crazy. And so in the 60s to the 90s, block heels became more prominent, followed by then again a stiletto revival in the early 2000s, like now.
Right. And I feel like, again, something we've talked about throughout this season, as we've seen through history and how it relates to, like, what trends are in style and stuff, is, like, this pendulum swing. So you can see even from, like, the start of what we're calling the modern heel and what we have today, it's like that pendulum has swung back and forth a couple times, even in the last 100 years. Like, or less than, actually.
As my dad always says, fashion always comes back around, you know?
Honestly, keep your parents' stuff.
Yeah, steal it and put it in some type of storage until it's back.
Or like an older sister or cousin or anything.
The ugliest thing you've ever seen will be dope again.
Yeah. It always comes back. It always comes back.
Always. Similarly, for men, high-heeled boots made a comeback in the 50s as the cowboy boot associated with Western movies, and in the 60s and 70s, beetle boots, Chelsea boots, winkle pickers with Cuban heels became popular among some subculture groups, including like the garage punk scene and mod subculture. So that was definitely like a trendy thing. If you were like an artsy boy, you would like wear some platform stuff.
I feel like Elvis was like one of the first people in like
the Beatles
and the Beatles. Yeah, we're like very influential in this, because if you look at like old recordings of their performances, like they were wearing little heels and they were wearing eyeliner, even if we want to get that specific, and like kind of challenging these gender boundaries in a new way for that time.
At that same time, a lot of feminists rejected the idea of heels. And just as an anecdote, there was a feminist Miss America protest in 1968 where protesters symbolically threw a number of feminine products into a quote-unquote freedom trash can, and these included heels, which were among the items protesters called instruments of female torture. They perceived that it enforced femininity, and they compared it to Chinese foot binding. So there were some people have been very against heels as a form of female control, because let's be real, heels make women less capable of doing physical things when you're wearing them. You know, you can't run as fast.
Yeah.
If you're like trying to get away, you can't like lift as much weight, you know? And so it becomes this tool that at this time some feminists believed that were a form of control by the patriarchy. And then now in the 21st century, high heel shoes exist in very gendered categories where women's shoes usually have thin long heels, men's shoes are in like a riding boot style and are short. And Paul Morris, a psychology researcher at the University of Portsmouth, argues that high heels accentuate sex-specific aspects of female gait, artificially increasing a woman's femininity. So many see the arching of a woman's back facilitated by wearing high heels as an imitation of a signal of women's willingness to be courted by a man, which is crazy. But it also, like, when you wear heels, makes, like, a booty tooch vibe, if we're quoting Tyra Banks.
I definitely do think that just, like, from personal experience, when I'm wearing heels, like, there's a lot of truth to, like, the feeling of not being able to do as much, not being able to be as agile, but an increase in, like, your own attractiveness or, again, that femininity or whatever, you know? And I think even, you know, we're seeing more and more, especially on social media, like men in heels. And that says the same thing, because it's crossing that gender boundary to like going into that feminine style, but like in a new age manner. Yeah.
Just to round it out, I wanted to talk about the health implications of wearing heels, because it's associated with like a whole spew of health risks. There are studies that prove that people who wear heels are at a greater risk of falls, musculoskeletal pain, and development of foot deformities and varicose veins. And so as an example, in 2001, there was a survey conducted by Penn State using 200 women and found that 58% of women complained of lower back pain when wearing heels, and 55% of women said they felt the worst overall back pain when wearing the highest heels. So that study argues that as the heel height increases, the body is forced to take on an increasingly unnatural posture to maintain their center of gravity. So this change position places more pressure and tension on the lower lumbar spine, which may explain some of women's complained severe back pain at a higher heel level. So that is just one of like the 5 to 10 studies I skimmed through in order to talk about how heels are not good for our body and like human development. And yeah, it just goes back to this idea of like women are the ones who are putting themselves at higher risk of, you know, physical issues and
for attractiveness.
For attractiveness. So if you want to wear heels and that's how you want to be perceived, which is by assumption, like more attractive, more feminine, this, that, and the other, like own it, do it. I wear heels once in a while. There's nothing wrong with wearing heels. But I think it's super interesting to open up this discussion around how this was all created.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
How easily heels were deemed as feminine, mm-hmm. which means it can easily be undone.
Yeah.
You know?
I agree. For sure. Thank you guys so much for watching season one.
Oh my God.
I can't believe we're done.
I'm so sad that we're done.
I know, but look out for season two. And yeah. Obviously, as always, make sure to check us out on our website, our Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, Discord. Also, we haven't even mentioned this, but merch. We have merch,
yes,
y'all.
Yes, baby.
Bush babies.
We Bush
have
baby
tanks.
Merch.
We have the cutest trucker hats. We have totes, stickers, all kinds of amazing goodies. Yeah. So definitely check out the website for that. And we also want to call out Aperture because they have provided lighting and our lighting looks incredible. So thank you, Aperture, for upping our studio setup. We love you. And with that is season one wrapped.
Oh my God.
I can't believe it. Thank you so much for watching. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at Bush Babies World, as well as our personal accounts at Roxetteresa and at Rachel Traw. And make sure to join our Discord to be an official part of the BB community. Make sure to stay up to date with everything we have going on at www.bushbabiesworld.com.